Get ready, Husky fans. MGM Springfield is going to be your go-to destination for all your post-game celebrations. It's the latest retreat from MGM Resorts International, the world's leading hospitality and entertainment company. Get ready as we're building excitement in Springfield, Massachusetts. The fun begins in 2018.
Talent matters. It always does. And scouting for the best talent is never easy. And trust me, we should know that. We spend months crisscrossing the country, my coaches and I, and we work countless hours watching game film, analyzing thousands of players to find the best talent. But if you're hiring for your business, you don't need to do all that. You just need our presenting sponsor, ZipRecruiter. They do all the legwork for you. ZipRecruiter's powerful technology learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. ZipRecruiter scouts talent for you. You need a stat to back it up. 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And my listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Gino. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Gino. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire and the official job site of college sports fans everywhere. This is Gino Auriemma, and this is Holding Court. So I don't want to hear any wisecracks.
This new generation of this 24-hour news cycle, everybody's looking for clickbait.
How are you going to fish off your yacht? I mean, you have a regular boat that you fish off?
I have another one, yeah.
Is this food any good there, by the way?
I think the food's great.
Well, of course you do. I mean, I think the food's great in my restaurants, too.
Everybody's looking for clickbait. That's it.
What the hell are you sitting around for? Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Holding Court with Gino Auriemma. I'm Gino Auriemma. Today, we're going to get an opportunity to talk with Dan Orlovsky, quarterback from the University of Connecticut, the pride of Shelton, Connecticut, an All-American quarterback in high school, came to UConn and ushered us into Division I football, and then spent 13 years in the NFL as primarily a backup quarterback. And we're going to talk a lot about what life is like when you're the other guy, the guy that you don't see on Sunday afternoons in the NFL, and what goes into preparing for that role. And it's fascinating. Fascinating story about being a kid and playing football for fun and then becoming a pro when pro football is your job and everything in between there. So hope you enjoy it. First things, it's happening the day that we're speaking here. What's it like when you're waiting on draft day to have your name called? What are the emotions like that day?
I mean, you range all over the place. I know for me, I had my draft day started when I got drafted. It was back when it was just a two-day event. Rounds 1 through 3 were on a Saturday, and 4 through 7 were on a Sunday. And I remember waking up Saturday morning as happy as I've ever been in my life, as excited and anticipatory and anxious, because, you know, a lot of people think or categorize as, man, these kids have been waiting, you know, working 4 or 5 months for this post their college career. But it's really a decade plus. You know, most of the kids start playing football as kids, as 8, 9, 10-year-olds. And a lot of them have that dream, even in that young age, to get there. And it's so, when you wake up that morning, it's a decade long or dozen years long of work building up. And you're finally at that day. And all that work that you put into it is going to pay off. And so you just get this euphoric feeling of it's finally here. And then as the day goes, you know, depending on how it falls for you is where your emotions go. I went from being incredibly excited in the morning time, and as the day went on and I wasn't getting drafted and I fell farther, further and further, I started getting angry. I was getting embarrassed because I thought I was going to go earlier. Everyone else thought I was going to go earlier. And you start doubt doubt starts to creep in, fear starts to creep in. I mean, all kinds of emotions start to hit you all at once, and time can't go fast enough.
What did they tell you going into the draft? Because we'll get into that in a minute. Where did they tell you that you were projected to go?
Yeah, you know, going into my senior year, I was on that Mel Kiper big board. And so, yeah, that kind of set my mind. Okay, I'm going to be a first-round pick. And then I had a pretty decent senior year, and I was still on the big board. So, again, my mind is very centrally focused on the first round. As the process went of Senior Bowl and Combine and workouts, you know, I started to hear second or third round, and then in conversation with my agent, you know, he would say, you know, I could see you going in the second round, and I could see you kind of slipping a little bit. And I'd be like, well, what does that mean? He'd be like, yeah, you just never know. And so he didn't give me anything for me to think that I was going to fall as far as I did to the fifth round, but I thought I would go in the second or third round. That's kind of the information that I had from my agent and some teams and whatnot. So really, that was my expectation level. And then once my expectation level didn't get met, it went south for me real quick.
Well, you brought up Mel Kiper and all this other stuff that goes into the whole draft thing. So these people that make a living out of projecting who's going where. So like you said, you're on the big board and you're a first round projected to go in the first round. So what did you do wrong that all of a sudden you went from the first round to the fifth round? I mean, you couldn't have changed that much.
Yeah, you know, I went to the Senior Bowl. That's when it started for me. I went to the Senior Bowl, and I didn't perform well. It wasn't a disaster either. I remember being at the Senior Bowl. It was, I think, our first day in pads. So I think the first or 2 days, if I recall, are just in shorts and whatnot. And then you actually get to put on full pads. And I didn't have a good practice. I was doing a lot of things that I had never done before. You know, a lot of my time at Connecticut was either in the shotgun or, you know, some play action pass underneath. Very rarely did I take a snap from underneath the center, drop back 7 steps and throw an 18-yard comeback all the way to the sideline.
Right.
Well, that's what I was doing at the Senior Bowl, and I struggled with it. And I remember in our hotel, they had this players lounge downstairs where guys could hang out at the end of the day. And I walked into the players lounge, and it's like it happened yesterday. I walked into the players lounge, and as I'm walking in, they're doing a SportsCenter special on the television that everybody's watching. All the players are gathered around it, and Mel Kiper's on there. And the anchor at SportsCenter goes, "Mel, whose stock has been hurt the most at the Senior Bowl?" And he just laid into me, and it was like a barrage all over me, and said, "This guy, he won't play in the NFL. He's proven that coming from the small school, it's not going to transfer, this and that." So that kind of went, it started to snowball for me. And truthfully, I don't know if it created a narrative or not, but it seemed to go from there to the combine to pro day.
Right,
and
right.
I don't think that I did anything different.
Right. Once you're labeled, well, he's the same guy that put you on the big board.
Exactly.
So he's the guy that put you on the big board. What, he didn't know you were at a small school playing at UConn?
Yeah.
So the thing that I have a problem with all these guys is how they influence the general managers, because then the general managers want to go, well, if this guy and that guy and that guy think this guy is really good, or if they're dropping, then I don't want to be second guessed by the same guy saying, "I told you not to take him," blah, 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 blah. And when you walked into that room, who were the quarterbacks in that room that you looked around and you went, "Damn, man, that guy right there, he's going to be a great NFL quarterback"?
Yeah, the guys that were on my team, I didn't think were any better than me. I mean, there was Kyle Orton, who went to Purdue,
yep,
and ended up being a fourth-round pick, really good pro. I mean, played for like 10 years, so played, yep, for a long time, had some success and whatnot. Jason Campbell was there from Auburn, who ended up being a first-round pick to the Washington Redskins, and you know, never amounted to being a first-round pick worthy guy.
Yeah.
I think he played for about 10 years or so good long career, but didn't become what Washington had hoped, certainly. Brock Berlin, who was a highly touted kid, yeah, out of high school, who went to Florida and Miami, okay. But there was no one in the room where I went, "Wow, those guys are so much better than me." My year, we had a bunch of younger guys get taken early. Alex Smith was the first pick of the draft. This San Francisco, he was a junior. Aaron Rodgers was taken by Green Bay. He was a junior. There's a couple other guys that were younger that were part of it rather than seniors coming out.
And when you get your name called, and you say, okay, well, I didn't go when I wanted to go, but here I am. What's that first conversation like with the people that actually called your name out? How does that process work?
Yeah, so mine was a little unique. I was sitting there in the third round, and I got a call from Seattle, who was one of those teams that I had a ton of interaction with leading up to it. And they called me, and it was mainly like a scout, a front office person. It wasn't their head coach or GM. And he said, hey, Dan, we want to just confirm this is your contact information. You're on our short list for our next pick coming up here in a little bit. And so immediately I was like, oh, I'm going to Seattle. And why would they call me and ask me for this information if they're not going to take me?
Right.
They ended up taking David Green, who's also another quarterback out of Georgia, a lefty guy, won a ton of games in college, never had a pro career. And so I end up getting into the fifth round, and I get a call from a 313 number. And so immediately my reaction is like, here we go. And I was just in a bad place, coach. And I was just like, all right, what are these guys? You know, like, what do you want to tell me now? You know, and I was just kind of doo-doo face. And I get the call, the 313 number, I pick it up, and it's Matt Millen and Steve Mariucci. Matt Millen, the GM, and Steve Mariucci, the head coach of the Lions at the time. And I just remember Coach Mariucci getting on, and I don't know if you know Coach Mariucci at all, but
I do.
Got on there and like, all right, bud, you ready for your wait to be over and to be a Lion? And in a way, only Mooch could do it. And in that moment, you know, it was almost like, truthfully, it was, I remember it. It was like when you hear people talk about near-death experiences and their life flashes before their eyes type thing. That's what it was like for me. It was like that dozen years of work that was put into it, from a kid to a teenager to a high school kid to a college kid. All those moments flashed before my eyes almost, and it became very emotional because it was like, finally, I've gotten that call. I've achieved that dream, and it's such energy that goes through your body.
And you go home, you know, you now got to get ready. What do you have to do to be even though it's like going from high school to college, you know, like the coaches will tell you, listen, before you get here, you need to be able to do this, 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 and this, and work on this and work on that. And then you get there and you realize, I don't care what I did, I'm not ready. You know, nothing can prepare you for the real thing. So when you first get a chance to work out with the Lions, what did you notice right away that, oh boy, I'm not at UConn?
Yeah, I think the first thing, I guess, non-physical stuff would be just the professionalism. I mean, no longer was I walking around with 18, 19-year-olds in stores, you know, sleeping on futons and playing video games. It was, this was not, you know, like, okay, this is a job. This isn't, it's not what you expected, because, or at least for me, I was like, oh, the NFL, this is, you know, the dream, and it's a kid game and whatnot. And to its core, it is. But to its everyday workings, it isn't. It's a job. And so the professionalism of these guys and how they went about their business stood out to me. Now, the physical part was, I had the expectation that, you know, when I went to the Lions, they had Roy Williams, who was a big-time receiver from Texas, Charles Rogers, a big-time receiver from Michigan State. So I had the expectation that these guys were going to be incredibly athletic, big, fast, strong. We had Dre Bly, who played DB, kid from North Carolina, big time NFL back. And so I had the expectation that those guys were going to be pretty special. The defensive linemen blew my mind. I remember just watching these guys work out and the way they would toy with weight, watch them run on the field and seeing how they moved, the agility and the athleticism that they moved with was something. I mean, I played against Miami in 2002, when they went to the national title and sent like 27 guys to the NFL, they weren't even close to some of these guys that I was playing with the Lions. And I mean, we had a guy named Sean Rogers, who was a big defensive tackle from Texas. They called him Big Baby. And this guy was 6'4", 330 pounds, and watching him run, he looked like a running back in college. I mean, it was remarkable, and I just remember the first time I had to go take a snap in practice against the starters was early on for me, and in a mini camp in the spring, and I remember walking up to the line of scrimmage, and he had this visor on, and I just looked at him like, whoa. that was my first time, and I said, okay, I'm not playing against Syracuse anymore.
Right, right. And I think that the people listening, when you watch him play, you watch an NFL game on TV, and you go, man, those guys are really good. And then it's not till you get on the sideline or till you're actually close to them and you see, like you said, a 6'4", 330-pound guy that can run faster than any guy you've ever played with.
It's
hard to believe, isn't it?
It's remarkable.
So going fast forward a little bit, what was it like when you found out you were going to get your first start? Because a lot of times, when you're on the sideline, and you're not the starter and something happens in the game and coach comes over and says, hey, let's go. That's one thing. But when you got to sleep at night and you're going to wake up the next morning and you're starting Sunday afternoon or Thanksgiving Day, whatever the case may have been in the NFL, what's that night's sleep like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a totally different animal. You'll hear a lot of guys, I'm just going to treat this like every other week and this and that. And you try to, but it's impossible. It's
right.
Truly impossible. The night before, the first start I ever got was in my third year in the NFL. And we were a bad football team, and I knew it. And it was pretty early on that became apparent. And I just remember it was on the road at Minnesota, and I tried to do everything I could that week to be normal, everything I could that day leading up to, that Saturday before the game leading up to it. And I remember going to bed the night before, and just as I decided to, finally get to sleep, okay, turn off the television lights and whatnot, I had this wave of, anxiety, not anxiety, but a little bit of am I ready for this?
Right.
This is the real thing is here tomorrow. And so, you have to do a lot of, for me, I had to do a lot of, self-talk because I had gone almost 3 years without playing. I had some time here and there and whatnot, but I had gone a good stretch without playing, and being the guy and having to start a game and having a huge impact on win or loss, losing that game. And so, I think over that almost 36-month period, doubt naturally started to creep in. And so that night I had to ask myself, okay, do I think I'm ready? Do I think I'm good enough? And truthfully, as I went to bed and finally shut my eyes, I said, well, tomorrow's my opportunity to prove to myself that I can go do this, that I belong, and that I can play and whatnot. So it was a unique night of sleep just because I had never not played, really. I had never not played, since I was a kid. And to go through that almost three-year stretch of not playing was very abnormal for me. And then for all of a sudden, the switch to be flipped again and then having to go be the guy, I had to reacclimate myself to it.
When you your first possession, when you stepped into the huddle, was there ever any feeling like, did you notice how the guys were looking at you and how they were evaluating or processing and looking at you and thinking, all right, what's this guy got?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In one way, I was very fortunate. When I walked into the huddle for that first start, I had a left tackle named Jeff Backus, who played for about a dozen years in the NFL, maybe even longer, big-time veteran. And I had a center named Dominic Raiola, who played for 14 years in the NFL. Now, at this point, they were probably like years 8 and 10 in their careers. And so in a good way, they were able to be in that huddle with me right away and kind of give me a little bit of affirmation. Like, hey, let's just go play, bud. Yeah. And at the same time, they were looking at me going, all right, you're the guy now. You have to lead us. It's time for you to go do that. I was really fortunate, though, Coach, because my high school coach, Joe Benanto, did a phenomenal job of imparting how big of a deal the huddle was and leading that and understanding that and embedding myself into
that leadership role in that moment of the huddle. And then when I went to UConn, Coach Edsel did the same thing of harping how big that huddle was, important that when I walked in there, everybody's eyes were on me, paid attention to me, that I commanded them, you know, that they needed me to kind of get them where they wanted to go. They would believe anything I said type stuff. And so I had really good coaching to handle that. So I felt pretty good walking into that huddle going, all right, I'm the guy now, I'm the leader now, follow me type stuff. So I was fortunate, but you can tell those guys were looking at, okay, let's see what you got, kid.
And your first pass attempt, and you complete the very first pass you completed ever in the NFL, and you know, okay, I'm going to be in the record books now, as when they look at, all right, Detroit Lions, this guy played in this game and this year, and he complete. You know that you've done something that very, 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 very few people in the world ever get a chance to do. And now you're getting back into the huddle, and you knew you threw that first completion, and you get this feeling like, whew, all right, it's like when you make your first, you know, you make your first bucket, or you get your first hit,
yeah,
or whatever. How much confidence did you get from something like that?
Oh, big time. You know, the first time you can get that completion and go, okay, that was a good result, a good end. Because that's for me, that's how simple as I wanted it for it to be early on. I just wanted to get the ball out of my hands into my guy's hands and let something good happen. And so once I did that, I was like, okay, and you settle into a little bit of a rhythm. Truthfully, for me, the first time that I finally went, whew, and could breathe is when I took a shot and threw it at the same time and completed it. You know, I wanted to get hit.
Right.
But also be throwing and complete the balls, because that's football. I mean, that's playing quarterback. It's not all of the time drop back, don't get touched, this guy's wide open, throw him the ball. You know, I wanted to feel like part of the action. For the first time, I remember it was that first game, and it was early on in the game, maybe our third or fourth play. I dropped back, and Minnesota was playing this cover two defense, essentially something that Tampa Bay, the Buccaneers, made famous basically 20 years ago. And their defensive end, Jared Allen, kind of made our left tackle whiff, and I just felt his pressure, and I got the ball quickly out of my hands on a slant to Calvin Johnson, and Jared flattened me. Calvin went for a good 15, 20-yard gain, and Jared got up, kind of pushed on my chest that helped me up, and he's like, good ball. And that was my moment of, oh, okay, the ball got out of my hands, good stuff. I just took a shot from maybe a potential Hall of Famer, and we're okay. That was my first moment of kind of breathing, whew, you know.
Well, they're not allowed to touch the quarterback now. It's not the way it used to be.
No. it's Jared would got a 15-yard flag for touching my chest after the play.
I know. You watch it, and you see, you know, when I was a kid and you watch some of those quarterbacks, there was no way they were coming out of a game without some blood coming out of their face or someplace,
no doubt.
You know, a broken finger, some shot that they took in the, you know, in the head. And, the football's changed. Well, you know what? That's why they throw it 50 times a game now.
No doubt. I mean, if you look at it, that's New England is kind of the first people to touch that. New England was the first team. When those rules changed and New England started throwing it 50 times a game, no one else was doing it. New England was so ahead of the curve with Belichick and Josh McDaniels and Brady going, wait, you can't hit the receivers anymore, because New England was notorious for beating receivers up in the playoffs. That's how they beat the Colts so often. You know, they just wear receivers out, and now the rules flip, and they know you can't do that anymore, and they were like, we're just gonna throw it every play. And that's what we see in the NFL nowadays, because you can't hit the receivers past 5 yards. Usually,
yeah,
it favors the offense. You can't touch the quarterback much. So it's a firework-driven league right now.
Yeah, yeah. For sure, that's what people want to see, right? People want to see a lot of touchdowns, a lot of completions. They want to be in the red zone the whole game, right?
Mm-hmm. That's why people love the Big 12 in college football right now, because every game's 65 to 62.
and you go now and you're in the NFL, and we'll back it up a little bit and say, And you and I talked about this last week at our at my leadership conference, and it's interesting because a lot of kids, you know, a lot of kids have that, you know, they pretend, you know. I see my grandkids doing it now, you know, they'll grab a ball and, you know, Villanova won a national championship in basketball, and I hear one of my grandkids, you know, he's dribbling and he shoots it and the ball goes in and he yells Villanova, you know. So every kid dreams about doing something spectacular, you know, to win a championship, to play, you know, at the highest levels. You know, when you dream about doing something like that, and you go to college, and you put yourself in a position to make those things happen. Do you ever say to yourself when you're in college, you know, if I don't make the pros, if I don't get this, when you set yourself up for that, if I don't get this, I really have set my whole life up for this. I don't know what I would do if I don't get a chance to play in the NFL.
I never thought that way, Coach. I mentioned this last week, like you said, I had a very clear understanding of what I wanted to go do. And I was one of those people that believed as long as I worked as hard as I possibly could at it and did the right things with everything that I did, it was going to happen. And my belief was if I did that stuff and it didn't happen, then it wasn't meant to be. But I was not going to be the guy that looked back. I can't tell you how many times I've got friends who've called me and said, I wish I would have. Mm-hmm. I wish I would have done more work. I wish I would have been more committed. I wish I would have sacrificed more. I wasn't going to be that guy. I was going to die trying. And, you know, I remember having some conversations with Coach Edsel at my time at UConn, even our academic people talking about school and whatnot. And I said, and I was very clear, and this wasn't the right thing to say at the time, but I was like, listen, guys, my main goal is to come here, get my education, and go play in the NFL. It was not to come get my education, see what I wanted to do or plan set up for myself after football. I wanted to go play in the NFL, and I wanted to do it for a long time at a high level. And so I had the exact conversation with my academic counselor, and she made the comment, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And I told her, and literally, like, with my hands, made the gesture of, my eggs are in. They're already in. And so I didn't want an out. That might have been the incorrect thinking at the time. I didn't want to give myself an out. I knew that as long as I stayed focused and on that one singular goal, that I truly believed I would get there. And if I didn't, I would cross that bridge when it happened, if it happened. But I didn't want two or three options to say, okay, if it doesn't work out, I was going to make it work out. And, you know, I was fortunate to stay healthy and have some good people around me that afforded that to happen. But I was a little bit maybe naive in my thinking. It was a one-way street for me.
Is your retirement game plan a well-executed play or a wild shot at the buzzer? Johnson Brunetti has helped over 2,500 Connecticut families prepare for a financially secure retirement, and they are proud to be the wealth management partner of the UConn Huskies. Visit them at johnsonbrunetti.com and see how they can help you with your retirement. Johnson Brunetti, retirement and investment specialist. Go to johnsonbrunetti.com for free books and financial planning tools. I just discovered something that's pretty extraordinary. I'd heard about it from some coaches and pro athletes, and now I've experienced it for myself. Mizzen & Main, Dallas-based company, is the maker of performance fabric dress shirts. Now you say, what's performance fabric? Well, you know, the stuff you work out in. So you get all the benefits of workout gear, but you wear it with a suit. You can dress it up, dress it down, put a tie on it, don't put a tie on it. So if you see me on the court lately, that's what I'm wearing. You don't know that it's a dress shirt. It feels like a casual shirt, but it looks like a dress shirt. Yet, it moves around you like workout gear. It's revolutionary. You can check out www.mizzen, and Maine. That's M-I-Z-Z-E-N and Maine, MAIN.com/Gino. See some of my favorite shirts. Take a look. You'll be impressed. Give it a shot. You know, I've always been a big believer that when you don't give yourself any options, you tend to make the only option that you have work. Because, you, like the saying goes, you have no other choice.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I think you're right about that. I think people say, well, you know, they give themselves an out and they give themselves a free pass. Like, well, I'll try this, but if it doesn't work, then here's why. I think when you say, no, there is no plan B. There's plan A, and that's it. And you, when you do that, you have a tendency to make it happen.
I mean, there was just
you would
no
agree
but.
With that.
There was no but for me. There was no but. It was all in.
When you pick Connecticut, when you could have gone to a whole bunch of other schools, bigger programs, more established programs, and obviously being from Connecticut, I'm sure there was some pressure to go to Connecticut, but I'm sure there was also a bunch of people that said, why do you want to go there? Like, you know, what are you going to get out of being there? You need to be someplace where they can help you get, you know, ready for the NFL. What was the thinking of why UConn?
Yeah, you know, Coach Edsel started recruiting me pretty early on, sophomore year of high school. And at that time, UConn had, outside of the state, had no relevancy in college football. And even inside the state, it wasn't a huge deal. And when he first came, I was like, well, that's cool. You know, I couldn't have cared less. You know, I was naive as a kid, first of all, but I couldn't have cared less. So, because I was getting letters from Florida, Penn State, Michigan, all those schools. And so my vision was I was going to go play in the Big Ten. And so I said, hey, Coach, he offers me. And I said, Coach, thank you. You know, thank you for the offer, all that stuff. But I did not pay any attention to that offer. And, you know, I wanted to go play at Michigan State or Purdue. Those were my two schools that I wanted to go to.
And why?
I wanted to play early. I really wanted to play early. And so Coach Edsel stayed on me. He was recruiting me throughout it, even though I was kind of giving him the cold shoulder in a way, you know, ignorantly. I was giving him the cold shoulder, and I was focused on those other schools. And what happened was Michigan State, my junior year of high school, Michigan State had this true freshman named Jeff Smoker start playing at quarterback, playing really well. And he was a true freshman. And I was like, well, I don't want to go there and sit for 2-3 years. So Michigan State kind of went by the wayside for me. And throughout this whole time, Coach Edsel's staying on me. And Coach Edsel's just preaching this vision to me. And he's giving me these tidbits of, we could do something no one believes we can. And you could be the first guy. You'll be the big fish in the small pond. And come help me do this. And everyone thinks we're crazy. All these little things. And I wanted to go to Purdue. So I'm on a visit at Purdue. And during my same visit, I come home. That morning, I'm going to call Purdue and to commit. And then that kid named Kyle Orton, who I had mentioned down at the Senior Bowl, called Purdue and committed that morning. Well, Kyle was like the fourth-ranked high school quarterback in the country, so I was like, I'm not going to go to Purdue. Kyle's going there, and I want to play early. I want to make sure that I have a really good opportunity to play early. And so I took a visit down to Virginia. Went okay, but I didn't want to go there at that moment, so I landed at the airport, and I called my dad. I said, I'm going to call Coach Edsel. I'm going to commit to UConn. And my dad hung up the phone. So I get home, and I call Coach Edsel, and he's in a staff meeting. And my dad gets on the other line. I said, Coach, I just want to let you know I'm coming to UConn. And, you know, the place erupts, and the staff erupts and whatnot, which was a great feeling, whatnot. My dad comes running down the stairs, and he's like, no, you're not. And he was a guy, he was like, no, you're not. And he's like, you're selling yourself short. You're scared of competition, this and that. And, you know, what I told him was this. Listen, I truly wanted to go. Coach Edsel sold me. I mean, he sold me on that dream. He sold me on that potential to go do, like I said, something that everyone thought was crazy. No one thought it could be done. People thought it was a waste of time. It's not going to happen. UConn, strictly a basketball school, all that stuff. And I
I fell in love with the challenge to try to go do that. I fell in love with the vision. I also fell in love with the fact that Coach Hudson wasn't going to be easy on me. I mean, he was not going to give me anything. He was going to grind on me, and I wanted that. And I told my dad this: if you believe that you did a good job raising me and gave me the skills to handle this, let me handle what I need. Let me make this decision because I truly feel it's the right one for me. It didn't matter what the school was anymore. It just mattered that Coach Edsel was giving me something that I fell in love with.
You know, a lot of kids go to the wrong place for the wrong reasons. And, you know, their parents a lot of times are the reason why, or their high school coach or someone influences them. So it's rare that you find kids that are going to stand up. And you know, I've always said, and I don't know if you felt this way too when you went to the pros, I've always said it's not necessarily, you know, where you are, you know, what their facilities are, who they're playing against. Because you know what? There's a kid that's going to get drafted today that plays at Wyoming. So you go, well, when have you ever seen Wyoming on TV?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kid that plays for the Eagles is North Dakota State. You know, so it's not where you go. It's who are the people that you're committing yourself to. And that's going to be the reason why it works or it doesn't work, not the place that you're at. Would you agree with that?
No, absolutely. You know, I remember having a very clear discussion with Coach Edsel because, again, I wanted to go to the NFL. And I remember sitting there with them during the recruiting process near the end of it. And I said, Coach, if I go to UConn, can I make it to the NFL? And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, absolutely. And in that moment, I think was one of those moments that swung with me, because if I had gone to Michigan State or Purdue, I don't know if I would have played. That's obviously a variable, but I wouldn't have been challenged like I was. I can guarantee you that I would not have been challenged like I was by Coach Edsel. I would not have faced failure like I did at UConn and been challenged to handle it the way that Coach Edsel made me handle it, and to stand up. You know, I did some stupid stuff, boneheaded stuff my rookie year when it comes to or my freshman year at UConn when it comes to academic. And Coach Edsel didn't let me slide at all. I mean, I got a 0.67 GPA my freshman fall because I went to UConn to play football. And he called me in his office, looked me dead in the eye, and said, I will never play for you. He said, you will never play for me again unless you get above a 3.0 for the remainder of your time here. And he wasn't playing. He was not just, that wasn't coach speak. He was dead serious. And so I say this all the time. If I didn't go to UConn, I would have never even sniffed the career that I had. I wouldn't be the person I am nowadays. I wouldn't be the husband or the father. I wouldn't even be close to it. And so as much as I love UConn, it was so much more about the coach that I went to UConn for. You know, it could have been Shelton High School all over again for me. As long as Coach Edsel was there with his staff, it would have been the same result. You know what I'm saying? It was because of him that I ended up doing some of the things I was able to do.
Well, it's funny because, you know, right around that time you were coming out of high school, we were recruiting a kid, Diana Taurasi, who, you know, was a completely different story. She was 3,000 miles away. And I remember saying to her, you know, the easy thing for you would be to go to school at UCLA because you live 25 minutes from there, half an hour from there. But I know what you want, and I know that in order for you to get it, you need to come here. And she came here, and it certainly wasn't because of, you know, the facilities or the campus or any of that other stuff, even though, you know, all that's, you know, fine. But she had the same approach as you did. I'm going to college, and somebody would say, why? Well, to play basketball at UConn. And I'm only going to go to class because I need something to do before practice starts.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
And it's funny because I think you two became friendly in some way, and you two are a lot alike.
Yeah. I mean, she was at school the same time as I was, like you said, you know, there was a girl, Maria Conlin,
yep,
from one of my, you know, town right next to me, and she played on the team and had an incredible career there at UConn. And so we had a ton of interaction with the team. And I always just admired them. One, because I was a lot like them and they were a lot like me, workers, very, you know, alpha mindset. And I loved Diana. I mean, we all did. I mean, who couldn't, who wouldn't, but we all did because, you know, we just admired, you know, I always admired people that were willing to be themselves and willing to kind of go after something and willing to have a little bit of dog in them, you know, a little bit of fight. And she had a ton of fight, but a little bit of that. No. I have a very clear vision of what I want, and nothing and nobody is going to stand in my way. And just understood who they were, weren't afraid to be themselves, weren't afraid to go after something and fail. And so I was fortunate to spend a good amount of time with her, become friends, and kind of just admire the stuff that she did.
Well, you know, she's going on to have an amazing career, obviously. And I think the same questions that I ask her all the time would be my next question is, and she hasn't faced this yet, but what was it like when you first had to change teams? You know, you're like, okay, well, you know, I got drafted by the Lions, I played here, and now all of a sudden I realize, as much as I already knew, this is a business as much as it's a sport.
Yeah, you know, the first time I changed teams, it was exciting for me because a lot of the NFL and pro sports is opportunity. And so the biggest chunk of playing time I got was the year before I was hitting free agency. And everyone knows free agency is the big moment for NFL players, especially because you usually only get to hit it one time. Mm-hmm. And so I caught a break with that. My biggest chunk, I played pretty well right before free agency. And so the free agency period is about to start. I'm back in Connecticut and it's Friday night at 8:00 at night. And I'm still young, so I don't know what's going on. This is my first free agency period. And I get a call from my agent. And he's like, hey, you're going to go on a plane tomorrow to Houston to go visit with the Texans. Then you're going to Denver and Seattle over the next couple of days. So I'm like, all right, perfect. So pack a bag, land in Houston and go to dinner and meet a bunch of people and whatnot. And so this is an exciting time for me, but I still don't know what's going on. And so I have no expectation level of contract or anything like that. And the next day I meet with the head coach, Gary Kubiak at the time, and the general manager, Rick Spielman. And my agent calls me, he goes, okay, we're going to talk about a contract. They don't want you to leave the building. I said, okay. And he goes, just go into the room and sit by yourself. So he calls me back about 20, 30 minutes later. And he goes, hey, so I've got them at 2 years, $4 million. And so I was like, yeah, sign it. I'm in. Totally. You know, I'm from Shelton, Connecticut. Yeah.
Right.
I wore $12 sneakers. And so I was like, sign it, done. He's like, nah, just let me work a little bit longer. And so in this process is when I'm realizing this is negotiation. This is a business. This is why I have an agent, and this is why these guys have their jobs. So he calls me a little bit later, and he's like, I'm up to like 3 years, $6 million. And again, my reaction is like, yeah, I mean, let's just end this so they don't change their mind or something.
Right, right.
And he goes, listen, I want you to hold your phone for the next hour. Just pretend like you're talking on it. Because I was in a room by myself. He goes, I just want you to pretend like you're talking on it. Let me work for another hour. I said, okay. So I'm literally there like an idiot, sitting there holding my phone, pretending like I'm talking. Finally calls back, goes, all right, I got them. They're up to 3 years, about $10 million. And so I was like, what? You know, and I couldn't, I was blown away just by the business aspect of it. And so, you know, obviously sign it. I never thought this would happen. You know, I was whatnot. And so, but that was my first moment to go, wow, this is a business. And then instantaneously the expectation level changed for me.
Right.
Though. When I put my pen on that paper, it was the expectation level for me changed 100%. And so that was one of those first moments switching teams when I said, well, this is a little different than I expected.
And you feel like, okay, well, they're paying me a lot of money. I committed myself. They committed to me. So a lot's going to be expected of me. And did you feel the pressure?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I remember I signed my contract and we did a press conference and with the local media. And I just thought to myself, I'm the backup quarterback. Why am I doing a press conference? You know, I was signed to be a backup. You know, Matt Schaub was the starter down there and he had a good run. He had been hurt a bunch, you know, the first 2 years. So it was a little bit more of a higher end backup at that time. But I was like, why am I doing a press conference? But yeah, I felt the pressure immediately, and it was different because it was a little bit similar to when I went to UConn, but when I went to UConn, I was a kid. You know, I was 17, and so there was pressure because I was highly recruited in Connecticut and the state. But when I went to the NFL, it became a very cutthroat pressure because it was I have seen guys that, you know, my first couple of years, I've seen guys that sign $5-7 million contracts, don't perform in that year, and then they get cut. I've seen a guy come in and sign a contract, and then the next day, literally the next day, get cut. And so the pressure to perform, especially when there's a number tied to your name, a large number tied to your name, is massive. And so, you know, it's one of the great things about the NFL, though. It's, you know, every single day you've got to go. Every day, because every team is always looking to replace the great majority of their guys on the roster with somebody cheaper. And you better go every day, prove that you're worth the number that's tied to your name.
Well, I think that's a part that gets overlooked a lot of times. I mean, fans watch games and they have no idea behind what they see on the screen on Sundays. So my next question then is, what's life like for a backup quarterback from Monday to Sunday?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I learned it near the back end of my career, but it's incredibly difficult. It really is because, you know, I have to do, as the backup, I do everything that everybody else on our football team does. Everything. I work out just as much as them. I practice just as much as them. I prepare just as much as them. I lift, I work out, I run, I eat, all that stuff. And then all those guys do it with the knowledge that they are going to play on Sunday. I do it with the knowledge that I'm not. Mm-hmm. And so you really have to go through this process of training yourself and almost brainwashing yourself to go and do all that work and invest all that stuff, knowing there's not going to be a return on your investment. There is no reward to be reaped. I just need to continue to, it's almost the hamster wheel. I have to continue to do it because that's my job. You know, on Monday, I would watch probably 4 games of the team that we're going to play the following week. And so each game, give or take, takes an hour and a half. So I'd watch 4 games and take a bunch of notes that were just very basic. This is who they are and whatnot. And watch a ton of film. I'd lift and work out just like everybody else, but watch a ton of film. And then Tuesday would be another massive film day, and I'd focus on, hey, these are all their blitzes. This is who they want to be blitz wise, and you kind of categorize it and tells, and this guy gives this blitz away, that guy gives that blitz away, and whatnot. And then the Thursday or Wednesday would go into a ton of their coverages. This is our coverages. This is how they play their coverages, because everybody plays, a lot of fans will hear cover 3, and everybody plays cover 3 differently. Everyone has different rules to what offenses are going to do or whatnot. So ton of coverages, revamping what, you know, again, checking the pressures, that the blitzes that you did on Tuesday. Then Thursday would be a little bit more focused of, okay, this is who they are in the red zone. This is who they are on third down. And again, all this is film watching. And I'm taking all this film watching and then giving it to our starting quarterback, you know, taking everything that I may find that he doesn't and making sure he gets it. Hey, man, you need to watch this clip against the Green Bay Packers because they did this. So he gets his eyes on it and taking notes. And as my career grew, I started to take all that information and share it with not only the starting quarterback, but the nickel DB who was going to be playing against the slot receiver for the other team, the third string running back who might have to play 5 snaps this game. And so it kind of became this, in a way, coaching role for me, where I was taking all this information throughout the week and all these hours, 30, 40 hours a week of film, and kind of sharing it with our whole football team so we were smarter.
And explain, because I think this is a big key. You know, like you said, you're preparing, but you're preparing not to play. You're preparing, mm-hmm. and yet at the same time, you're one play from having to go in and win the game for them. So yeah, mm-hmm. part of it is, well, yeah, I got to do everything that everybody else does, but I'm not, you know, there's a pretty good 99.9% chance I'm not going to play. Yet at the same time, you have to prepare, like, if you come off the sideline and take your first snap in the third quarter and you guys are down six, you have to perform like the starting quarterback and the team can't miss a beat. How do you get your mind around that?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is no one cares that you're the backup. No one's going to make an excuse that you've been standing around for two quarters. You have a job, and your job is to go perform when called upon. And that's why teams choose to pay you or not to pay you. Early on in my career, I was so focused on prepare yourself. And what I realized was there's 53 guys on a team, and everybody else is going to play but me. So I had to find value. I had to find ways to bring value and worthy of one of those 53 spots. And that's when I got into the role even more so of preparing everybody else on our football team. And as I started to do that, I realized that I was preparing myself even more than I was in my early years, because I was gaining so much information and breaking it down in different ways for so many people that I was becoming more prepared. I was ready to play because I was sharing so much information with everybody else. And so it was kind of this growth process throughout my career. Now, I had to do some things differently. I'd have to be the guy to stay after practice and get more reps throwing because I wanted to be ready. You know, if we put in a couple new plays that week in practice, I obviously don't get to reps. In the NFL, the backup doesn't get any reps with the starters. They just run the scout team. So if we put some new plays in with some new pass routes, I wanted to stay after practice and throw those pass routes because you had to have the mindset. I'm telling you, it's a very unique mindset. And I remember having a conversation with a coach near the end of my career going, people have no idea how hard it is to, one, prepare to play and prepare knowing you're not going to play. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating balance act. So I would have to make sure that I was ready to play, but also make sure that I was bringing value to our team. And so it's a unique way to go about doing your job. You have to truly commit to it. You know, that's why a lot of guys don't do it for a long time, because eventually it's like, well, I'm doing all this work and not getting anything out of the tough mindset. So I had to truly be all in. And once I became all in for the team, truly all in, and did all that work and didn't care if I reaped any of the benefits, is when I felt most prepared to go into games.
So knowing all that and having said all that, I think that the listeners would probably, I would say this because I'm from Philly where you live right now. So two questions I want you to answer. One, if you're Carson Wentz and you have this incredible season and the team is a Super Bowl contender and you realize after a certain time that there's a pretty good chance we have a chance to win the Super Bowl. And then you get hurt. And you know, that's it. Season's over. We might go to the Super Bowl, and I'm not going to be a part of it. One. Two, you're Nick Foles, and you've been sitting on the sideline after you were a starter, after you were traded, after you were on the verge of quitting football. And now here you are, and you go win, loss, and win the Super Bowl. And now, both of those guys, if you're Carson Wentz, how do you feel when you're watching that? And if you're Nick Foles, how do you feel when you know when next August comes around training camp, I'm right back to being the backup?
Yeah, if I'm Carson Wentz and I'm sitting there watching that, I'm torn to shreds.
Yep.
Just being honest, I'm torn to shreds because he may not know it right now, but those opportunities are rare. I mean, they're rare to go on runs like they went on and to have some of the success. And when you play quarterback, it's different. It's just different. It's like playing a, I don't know the position comp it would be to other sports, but you're the guy. Everybody looks at you. You're the leader. You're your team's president, however you want. You're the team's. We're going into battle, and you guys just follow me. And when you get into that mode where you're not only playing well, but then you are fully invested in that role, and everybody is behind you, and you've got that group of men doing, you know, following you. There's really, besides maybe getting married and having kids, there's not really a feeling that can match it. And so to have that moment, to have those moments and to be in that space and get it yanked out from underneath you, and then to watch that team go and do what they did, it would rip me apart. Because the one of the greatest things about team sports is team and going to do it with your buddies, going to do it with your friends, going to do it with your teammates, and to not have that opportunity, I would imagine, was tearing him to shreds. I'm sure there was a small part of him that was happy for his teammates and happy for his friends, but the great, I would imagine the huge aspect of him going, I want to be out there. I'd rather fail than not be a part of it. And for Foles, I know Nick a little bit. Nick and I share an agent. When I was referencing how hard it is to be the backup, I think what we saw last year was Nick reaping the benefits of having been in the backup, in some places, and learning differently, and handling things differently, and failing differently, and succeeding differently. All helped him to kind of step into that role and just see. Nick did a great job of being the guy, but then being just a guy. And he was able to handle the role of being the starting quarterback and leading his team, but also just fitting into one of 11. And it'll be a really unique process for him going through this summer and into next season going, wait, I just led this team to the Super Bowl and won MVP and went on an incredible run, and now I'm just high-fiving people on the sidelines. You know,
right.
It's going to be a little bit different for him. But at the end of the day, that's his job, and that's what his team's called him to do. His organization pays him to do, and you have a decision. It's you either do your job or someone else will. And I think it's evidenced by some of the stuff he did last year there that he's willing to go do his job because that's what the team has asked him to do.
Husky fans, I know there's no one more loyal than you, and I appreciate that. You know what else appreciates loyalty? AAA. So much so that they'll reward you for it, like how you get savings on AAA auto insurance just for being a AAA member. And the longer you're a member, the more you could save. Have both AAA auto and AAA home insurance? You could save even more. Have you been loyal to your existing insurance company for a while? Well, they'll reward that too with a discount when you switch to AAA. But your loyalty gets you more than savings. It gets you comprehensive help from an expert agent who gets to know you, because when your AAA expert agent knows you better, they can help you better. For insurance that's not just insurance, turn to AAA. So he's under contract to the Eagles, so they kind of fixed his contract a little bit so that he's obviously well compensated, and now he's going to start the season as the backup. When his contract's up at the end of the year, you envision some team coming in and saying, okay, we want you as our starting quarterback and we're going to pay you X. And now he says, yeah, absolutely.
I don't see it. I think the thing that we've seen this offseason, and I said this kind of, when they were going on their run, he's going to still get a good amount of money. I don't see a team coming in and saying, hey, come be our starter. Because, I said this throughout the season, the Eagles had so many variables around him for success. They had one of the best play callers in the NFL in Doug Peterson and a phenomenal offensive coordinator in Frank Reich and quarterback coach DeFilippo. And they had a really – I mean, their offensive talent was really strong. So when you head into free agency this past year and he could have been traded for, teams and general managers have to go, well, do we have all those pieces to give Nick Foles the chance for success around him? Can he replicate success without that play caller or without those pieces on offense? So I don't anticipate a team, because if a team didn't view him as a starter this year, they probably won't view him as a starter next year. Mm-hmm. And so unless Carson doesn't come back healthy and Nick again gets a greater opportunity to play, continues to play at such a high level, I think he'll be viewed as just a really high end backup, which is, you know, it's a good place to be in the NFL right now because of, you know, the opportunity to make some good money and, you know, maybe not have some of those pressures on you that can wear on you, I guess. But I think people are just going to view him as a really high end backup.
And, you know, Sundays when you get up in the morning and there's no game for you to play in, no game for you to get ready for, do you still watch the games?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Coach, when I was playing, you couldn't pay me enough money to watch games. I mean, maybe if it was a really interesting Sunday night matchup or Monday night football matchup.
Right.
But regular football, Sunday afternoon or a Thursday night game or, you know, in my eyes, just kind of like a boring Monday night game, I want no part of it because that's all I did all day was watch football, practice football, and work at football. I didn't watch it. And then when I got done playing this past season, week one was a little bit weird to me because I hadn't gone week one of a football season without being part of a team since I was 7. So that was weird for me. As the season went on, probably after 2 or 3 weeks, I settled in, and then I couldn't wait for football to come. I wanted a game every day type thing. I couldn't wait for football to be on Sunday mornings. I'd get excited and whatnot. So I've totally become a fan in a way where I want to watch it all the time and be consumed by it and just be entertained by it.
And you spend more time now, obviously, with your family and with mm-hmm. your kids and, do you see yourself ever saying, you know, I need to get back into the game? Have you ever been lured by the coaching bug at all?
Oh, absolutely. You know, to be honest with you, I had a chance to join 2 staff this season. Right when I got done as a player, I got calls from 2 teams to say, hey, we would like to have you kind of join our staff as a coach. I needed a break from being a player. Like I said, I'd been a player since I was 7, and so I needed some time to decompress from football. I would absolutely love to coach. I mean, not all what I've done for the great majority of my career as a pro, and probably even more so in the last 6 or 7 years, is kind of coach. That's been my greatest strength and essentially my role. So I love it. I love the impact that it has. I do know this, that especially at certain, you know, at the college level, it's a little bit more structured, but the NFL level, it's scary. I mean, I know coaches who have lived in 7 different cities, 7 different years. And so kind of putting my wife and kids through that for the back end of my career, living a little bit, I don't know if I'm ready to jump in there just yet. You know, I'm going to entertain kind of being a part of television more and bringing the fans closer and closer to the game and whatnot. But I'll always want a coach. Just I kind of feel like it's in my blood in a way.
Well, I think everybody that plays, you know, the first couple years out, you know, are the toughest. I think after that, you kind of settle into what we like to call, there's a normal life out there, away from practice, away from team meetings, and away from the constant pressure that you're under every day, like you had said. And I think the successful people end up saying, what's my skill set beyond, you know, calling a game from the huddle, and can I call a game from the broadcast booth? Can I, you know, use my leadership skills in the business world? You know, how do I kind of capitalize on the skill sets that I've achieved? And I'm sure it's down the road for you, but it is an incredible journey that you've had, as you've talked about, from being a kid and having the highs of, you know, being a starter to backup to trying to find a new team. And it's remarkable, because most of the time everybody you talk to was a star in the NFL. They don't know anything about what it's like to be that other guy all they know is being the guy, you know. And it's it is remarkable, and I think the people listening got a real sense of, you know, when they're watching the NFL, they're going to see that, there's 11 guys on the field, and then there's another 11 when the defense comes on, and then maybe there's the second string guys. But the guy on the sideline with the headphones that the quarterback talks to when he walks off the field, he's got as much to do with what happens on Sunday afternoon as anybody else. And
absolutely.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on and talking about it, Dan. And
no, thank you. This is, you know, for a guy that was there when things were, I mean, the things have been rolling there for a long time for you guys. So, but enjoyed being there and being a fan of yours and your team. So this is kind of a big honor for me. So thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate it. And best of luck. And if you ever need anything, if there's anything we can do for you, you know where we are, and we'd love to hear from you.
Absolutely, Coach. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Later, bud.
Bye. Well, there you have it. Amazing guy, amazing story. Dan Orlovsky, again, played in the NFL all those years as a backup, and you got to hear how he prepares, what his mindset is during the week, how he's responsible for more than what you think of as, well, he's standing on the sideline with a clipboard, and what goes into being that guy, and the pressures and the expectations and the trials and tribulations. So thank you for joining us. We'll be letting you know when our next podcast is going to happen. And until then, take care. Thank you for joining us on Holding Court with Gino Auriemma. See you soon.